Accession number 13358, Mr. H. Wilkinson, Reel 8.
Mr. H. Wilkinson, Reel 8. You were recovering from your wound and your concussion, Mr. Wilkinson.
Yes.
How long did that take?
Well, looking back, I think it must have taken about 7 or 8 days before I got out of that hospital, before they let me out. And I think I'd mentioned about this old Arab being in the corner. I believe I'd mentioned the POW, and then the following day there was seemed to be a company of Gurkhas arrived, and they were billeted in the hospital because there were no other casualties in at that particular time. And there was a Gurkha next to me, and I'd tried to converse with him, but he didn't know any English. And shortly after I'd tried to talk to him, the cook sergeant and an orderly were coming round with chapatis, and they gave me a couple. And this cook sergeant could speak good English, and I told him I'd been trying to talk to this chap next to me and ask him to see his cookery. And the cook sergeant said, well, he'll show it you, but he'll have to draw blood. So he spoke to him and translated to me, and I was agreeable. So he got his cookery, showed it to me, and he just licked me on the wrist. And he nicked himself and put the blood together, just like you see in the old cowboys and Indians. And he said, he's a friend for life. He says, if you're in any danger anywhere, he'll come to your assistance straight away. And he did give me his address on a scrap of paper. He says, if you write, somebody will interpret it. And you'll get a letter back of some sort. But with it being on such a small scrap of paper, which it was, just about a couple of inches or so by an inch, inch and a half, eventually it got lost. But I always remember that. After a while, I got out of that hospital. I'd been doing a couple of days in the officer's mess, as they called it. And I was getting bored stiff, actually, and they'd wanted me to stay there and become an officer's orderly. And I said, no, thank you. I said, you'd rather go? I said, yes. So they said, well, fair enough. And they let me come out. So I'd got my rifle and what equipment I had. I don't know. It must have looked rather comical, anybody watching from behind it. Just like walking away into the sunset. I was marching towards Marath area, all on my little Todd. And then I came to this little slope on my right with a little bit of tufty grass round about it and a little stone shack sort of thing. And there's a couple of chaps there. I can't remember what regiment they were. But I was talking to them, and they were saying they were expecting some aircraft. So they pointed the way up the slope behind them onto a level part, and these aircraft landed, and troops got out, and officers, and our adjutant was there. because I lined up with them. And he come down the ranks and he says, I seem to know you. I said, yes, sir, and I told him the relevant story. And, he says, well, you better climb aboard and come back with us, which I did.
Do you remember his name?
No, I can't. I'll be quite honest, I can't. A lot of the names slip as the years go by. Anyway, when I got back to company office, as it was, I reported there. And I said, I wished you'd come back an hour sooner. And I said, why? I said, well, you've just been reported missing, believed killed. And the telegram's gone off to your wife. And it seems as though these were reinforcements. I think I was the 11th man that was left in our company at the end of the action by what they were saying. And of course, had I been that hour sooner, that telegram wouldn't have got to the wife.
To go back to the battlefield conditions, this was your first action. What stands out about a battlefield?
Well, quite a number of things. Mainly the noise and the smell of cordite. And as the hours go by with the heat, the smell of dead death. And just wondering who the hell is left, you know. Anybody left that you know, that you can talk to, really, that you went in with.
But you were taken straight out, in effect, with your injuries. Does the battlefield leave you drained? Or?
Oh, yes. Once I'd got there and come to a bit, I thought how peaceful it was, how quiet, and actually how cool with being in this big marquee with the half a door open at one end and the opposite half at the other, you know, and you got a bit of air through and you were rested. You were well watered and well fed, considering. After that, well...
Is there any anger left in you after a battle when you've seen so much violence and death? Does it leave you with any thoughts of how did I get in? Who put me here?
Well, how do you mean that? As becoming a soldier at all and coming into battle, or just in the case of that particular action?
In general terms.
In general terms. Well, I felt sorry for the lads that went down, particularly those that I knew more closely, and the thought of families that were left without a father or a husband, you know. And quite strangely, after a day or 2 days, you just readjust somehow to the original life. Army life again. You put your private thoughts away. You got to, because at times I think if you didn't, and you were so inclined, you could go mad or want to get the hell out of the theatre altogether. There was one chap, a Cockney, I can't remember his name, but it was supposed that he'd done that very thing, and he'd got as far back as South Africa. How, I don't know. But he'd been caught up with and done a few days in clink and then been posted back under escort. So whether that tale is entirely true or not, but that's the tale that I did hear.
When you rejoined the battalion, what condition were they in? You've already said there was very heavy losses.
Yes.
What was the morale of like of those that were left?
Well, they were very quiet, I must say. Very quiet. because, I mean, with so few men left in the company, that they were bound to feel it, as I did, admittedly I did. But I don't know whether it's because I didn't have any, well, I had family at home, but I was estranged. And I had to stand up for myself all along. I stood on my own 2 feet before I went into the army. So whether I was adjusted to standing on my own 2 feet and devil take the hindmost, I don't know. Possibly there was a bit of that about it.
Had you lost in your own platoon company, you lost a lot of men, had you lost any officers, NCOs, people who you'd got used to?
Major Wilmot was one that I did know of that had been killed. I can't remember our lieutenant at that particular time. I don't know whether it was prior to a Captain Walton or whether Captain Walton was with us. I don't know. Strangely enough, within the upheaval of Marath itself, lots of thoughts got taken away from you. You know, you seem to be so busy and so full of thoughts and what was going to happen and what you had to do, that in lots of cases names just didn't seem to be needed somehow.
What happened to you next?
After Marath? Well, pulled back somewhere and I can't quite recall for a little while. And then we were preparing and prepared to go on to Wadi Akrit. Yes, Wadi Akrit. A bit vague about how long the interval between the two, but I know that when it did come, we were all formed up to go in, and all of a sudden there was a tap on my shoulder. Shh, all right, Johnny, all right, Johnny. And it was a Gurkha. And it seemed as though they'd come right along our lines doing that. Never heard a thing till they were tapped on the shoulder. And it was supposed to be that we had to stand down, that they were taking our place in the initial attack. But eventually we went into Akrit. And I remember, as we went in, there was this track. It was rather a stony escarpment, giving way to a hollow within itself and the ground rising around and about. And there's this sandy way in with bits of flint in, and there's a telephone cable on our left. But it seemed as though it had been cut or blown or something. And there was maybe 3 or 4 of us pretty close, and we heard this motorbike coming. So we grabbed this telephone cable, each side of the track, and a couple each side holding tight, just about chest height. And this motorbike came roaring down. The motorbike went flying and the bloke went flying on his back. It was an Italian. Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia. It frightened the life out of him, to be polite. And we handed him over to somebody and I went to the left. I remember going into this dugout place and it was marvellous to look at, really. And right opposite the entrance, at the far end of it, there was a shrine. It was an altar with the photo of the Virgin Mary and little candles either side and pictures. And I found a little Beretta. I pocketed that. And then I went on from there just as and wherever, just more or less, I think we're more or less clearing up. And I, as I moved on forward and farther to the left, I came across this corpse, face down. He had German insignia on him, but he was a reporter, a newsman, you know. And he just looked as though he was face forward. And then two fellas came, and I don't know who they were or where they were from. And they started hacking some of his fingers off to get these rings off. And I remember one was a beautiful ring. And I said, oh, for God's sake, I said, stop it. I says, if there's anything to pick up, I says, you needn't do that. And they said all sorts of unpolite words to me. Anyway, it was too late. Off they sloped.
Was there a lot of battlefield looting?
No, that's the first that I ever came across. I found in general that maybe chaps had picked things up off the battlefield, but not of any direct looting, you know, of bodies. I know I didn't. I don't know why, but it was a thing that I was prejudiced against. If I'd taken any prisoners at any time and they more or less forced things on me, yes, that was different. But I never, ever attempted to take things off anybody, because I thought if I was in the same position and I had to go into a prison camp and I had any personal objects that I would like to hold, that's the way I looked at it now. I gave them that consideration. Whether I was soft-hearted at times or what I may have been, but I looked on it that way. I never liked to defile the dead, no matter what nationality they were, Italian, German, or whatever. But there was instances when I had prisoners and they'd give me things. And I'd try to say no, but they somehow got it to me. They explained to me a bit of English and a bit of sign language that if I didn't take it, somebody else would. So I acquiesced and agreed. If that was what they wished me to have, fair enough. But I never pinched anything off anybody or forced anybody to give me anything. If there was anything laid about, like a pistol, a Beretta, or maybe chocolate or something like that, you know, the chocolate rations in the tins, I'd pick them up. But other than that, no.
After the noise and the tension of the battlefield, and you came across, as you say, the Virgin Mary in a dugout and a body, did that bring home to you that these were just men like yourself?
Well, you did, yes, even if it was briefly. Yes, as I say, the dead were dead, whoever they were, and they were somebody's husbands, brothers or sons, you know. But still, the job was there. It was war. You couldn't get out of the fact. I mean, if you didn't shoot him, he'd shoot you. Or he'd stick you, or you'd... whatever. And that's the name of the game, as it was. If game you can call it. I mean, you look back and then you consider, was it worth it, after all? Especially the situation we're in now. I think we won the war and lost the flipping peace.
What happened to you next?
We went farther ahead towards Amphideville. Then we stopped and came back down to the Red Sea.
You would know by this time that you're really driving the Germans and the Italians, of course, out of Africa.
Yes.
How did you feel about being stopped in your situation and not seeing the job finished?
Well, actual fact, we thought it was. As far as we were concerned, anyway, it was. And we came back down to Aqaba, and we trained round about Aqaba and on the boats on the Red Sea, down the scrambled nets.
Were you given any leave when you got back to the Delta?
Yes. After a while, we got to Alexandra, and it was when we were in this camp, we were split. I think half went into civvy billets in Alex, and half of us were left in the camp. And the half that went into civvy billets, pardon me, they got 7 days leave, and those that were in the camp, we got 11. That was to make up for time travelling from the camp into Alex and coming back in the evening. And I was among those that was left camp. And we had quite a lively time. I don't know whether the MPs had been told to soft pedal, but the first time we were in Alex, and it was night time, of course, most of the chaps found various bars, and I quite enjoyed myself in one of the bars. Of course, with not being used to alcohol for quite a while, it didn't take too long to have an effect on me. And I think I threatened to clear the whole flaming bar because one of the gypos had said something that I objected to, or his manner. And I was hustled out of there. One or two of my mates said, "You little sod, you'll have another war on your bloody own if you go on." So we went to the cafe place and got some eggs and chips and got back to camp. That was the first night. Oh, it was quite interesting. It was quite a change getting in among into a town, seeing civvies, other than uniforms all the time. Some of the lads quite enjoyed themselves at number 6 Sicily Street, I believe.
Which was?
Which was the place where the naughty ladies were. I know that there was a lad with us. He'd been on board ship. He'd been along with us all the time, more or less. He was one of the very few left that I knew. I called him Ted Allen. And he had the sweatiest feet in the British Army. When he took his sand shoes off on board ship, oh my God, terrible. Talk about bad breath, it was worse than, far worse than that. And he took quite an interest in the ladies. He was there every day, and I think he had maybe 3 or 4 every day.
You've been away from women for a long time, so the attraction was obviously very strong.
Mm. Yes, it was. Mm. I went in and resisted and resisted and resisted. And
did you come across in Alexandria many of the back servicemen who in the non-fighting units?
In Alex, No, I can't recall doing that. Seemed to be more or less our own companies and the MPs. But we had no trouble. In fact, I think that the mayor had been told to soft pedal it because there was that many of us, and if we'd ganged up on them, there might have been murder. So things went relatively quietly.
Was mail coming through to you all the time that you were in the desert?
Oh, that's a point that I missed in the first instance, because when we got to Geneva, and the very next morning, there was a letter for me, and all the other chaps were saying, "You lucky bastard, a letter so early." And shortly after that, they started getting mail, and believe it or not, as true as I sit here, I never got another letter for 6 months. And I got a whole bundle tied up just before Marath, and I hadn't time to read them all. No, I had to.
How were you feeling after such a long time of getting no letter? Because it must have been a constant worry of what was going on.
Well, I was wondering what was happening at home, whether they'd been bombed or whether it was just the mail. But I think some of it had been to India. They had all sorts of flaming stamps on. How it had got there, I don't know, but it must have been about 4 to 6 inches thick of letters tied in a bundle. And I mean, you know how thin letters are, and especially those days, it was just a brief sheet, more or less, and all kept tied together.
When you wrote home yourself, did they have to go through offices to be censored?
Oh, yes, they were censored, yes. Yes. I mean, if everybody had to put down on paper exactly what they thought, and maybe in some instances thought of particular NCOs or officers or anything like that, it wouldn't have done, would it? So you wrote pretty briefly, really, just saying you're more or less well, and that was it, and left names and numbers out of it.
You say you went into training. What form did that take?
Training?
In the Delta.
Oh, you mean Red Sea area, Aqaba? Oh, it was just more or less, apart from being on board the ship and using scramble nets and down into boats and landings, and then there was a scheme rigged up where I think Indian troops were supposed to be enemy, and we were assaulting from the sea. I'm not sure whether it's true or not, but it was supposed to be that one or two of the enemy had been killed. So there must have been live ammo used.
Were you curious as to why you were getting this training, with any thoughts upon where you might be going next? Any rumours?
Well, we didn't know actually where we were going to head until more or less the last minute, but of course the way things were going, you could tell there was something in the air, that we weren't going home. So it turned out that we were heading for Sicily invasion.
Were there any, prior to this knowledge, were there any thoughts, you know, people come around and say, "Oh, well, we're going here, we're going there." Was there any favourite place that you may be going to?
No, I never heard anything. No at all. To be quite honest, I didn't. We just accepted the training and did as we were told, and just wondered whether it was part and parcel of something coming up, or whether someone were going to be lucky and get leave out of the country. But it didn't work out that way. It was Sicily.